You're listening to the School Success Formula. This is episode number 50. Hello and welcome to today's show. Today we're going to be talking about how to keep revising when you're grieving, because this sadly is something that comes up over and over again in my inbox every single exam season. So today I've got on the show a grief expert and hypnotherapist to help us with this very difficult issue. However, before we go over to today's interview, I just wanted to say thank you so much if you have stayed on my email list after the GDPR debacle, which ended last Friday, if you're listening to this in the week it's published. So if you stayed on my email list to receive my weekly newsletter with updates about the podcast or updates to recent blog posts or links back to timely blog posts that I wrote in the past, I want to thank you. If you haven't managed to keep on the email list, or if you'd like to join the email list so that you can get a bit more inside information and just really be kept in the loop, then please do so. You can do that on my email by going to my website, and you can find livemoreextraordinary.com/newsletter. So it's livemoreextraordinary.com/newsletter. So I really hope that you'll go on over and you'll continue hearing from me. I've had some lovely feedback from parents and students, in fact, about being on my email list and about how much they like it. So one parent, Rosie Ward, said, "I love getting your emails and find them a huge help and great comfort in helping me support my children in the best way possible through their exams. If only I had the same kind of support when I was doing my own." So yeah, come on over and join the newsletter. So let's go over now to the interview. Every year, I very sadly get students or parents approaching me to ask how they can revise for their exams and do their very best while they're also coping with grief. Having never lost a close relation myself, I don't have any personal experience to draw upon, let alone professional advice to share, and I'm usually left feeling very inadequate in my ability to help. So, when I had a message this year from a mother who had lost her own mother and was grieving, but also trying to support her grieving daughter to prepare for her GCSEs, I knew I had to find an expert to help. Our guest today is the mother of two teenage boys, author of Good Grief, A Companion to Change and Loss, a clinical solution-focused hypnotherapist and a grief expert, so she's perfectly placed to help us. Welcome to the School Success Formula, Dipti Tate.
Hi Lucy, and thank you so much for having me on.
It's great to have you here. So first, Dipti, can you tell us about your own personal experiences of loss and how you came to be a grief expert? Because I don't suppose that that was your ambition from when you were a little girl.
No, you're quite right. I didn't sit there at school and think, I know what I'm going to do when I grow up. I'm going to be a grief expert. It really wasn't in my radar. It actually happened because of my own experiences through loss. Myself, I'm an only child, and basically I lost both my parents to cancer when I was quite young. So in my 20s I lost my father, and in my 30s I lost my mother. So the book came about really from my own way of healing myself and processing what I was going through myself. I didn't really understand grief at the time, and then through my own writing, and it became more of a cathartic vent for myself, and then realised later on it was actually, there was a book in this.
Okay, so like you said, your own writing, was it your own kind of journaling and that kind of thing that helped you through your grief? And how distinct was that from your hypnotherapy training?
Yeah, so the interesting thing is when I lost my father, I wasn't actually a hypnotherapist. I used to work in television, so it was a completely different career. And then when I lost my mother, that's when I started training as a hypnotherapist. So, of course, I loved my parents exactly the same, but what I noticed was really interesting. The difference in my own ability to grieve and process had drastically changed by the time I got to my mum than it had been when I was at my when I lost my dad. And I really do think that the solution-focused hypnosis and hypnotherapy model really did help me through.
Yeah, okay, that's really interesting. So when people are studying for exams, they often have huge emotional overwhelm because of the stress of the situation. So firstly, can you explain to us what is emotional overwhelm and how does it show itself in your brain and your behaviour?
Well, emotional and overwhelm are two words that sit nicely together. Mm-hmm. They do go hand in hand. And the reason why is because it's actually easy to get overwhelmed by your emotions because your emotions are really not easily containable. Emotions don't really sit or fit nicely and quietly into a box. Whenever I describe strong emotions, I always talk about them like if you have a little toddler and you're going on a car journey, and just before you put the toddler and strap him or her into the seat, you've given him or her a load of sweets to eat, and then you expect them to just sit there quietly, but that's not going to happen.
No.
So, they will often be unpredictable and loud and wriggly and erratic. So by definition, emotions are really designed to get your attention. So that's why they can feel overwhelming if you don't know how to control them and, work with them.
And presumably you get that sense of emotional overwhelm, say if somebody's doing their GCSEs and they've just broken up with their boyfriend or something like that, they're going to get that sense of emotional overwhelm from that source as well.
Oh, completely. Everything is going to add up and be kind of stored in what we call a stress bucket. That's our hypnotherapy term for the part of the brain that holds on to negatives and stress. So if in that scenario somebody's going through grief as well, if they've broken up with a partner or a boyfriend or a girlfriend, it's a loss, isn't it? A significant mm-hmm. loss. So therefore grief is going to be part of that, remit really.
Okay, so what is grief? Is it distinct from emotional overwhelm or is it just a more extreme version of it?
I think it is a more extreme version of it, definitely. Grief is I describe it like a tangled ball of string. It's like a really tight knot and it's very, very unpredictable. So when you're grieving, it's not a linear thing. It's a kaleidoscope of mixtures of roller coasters of emotions, ups and downs, roundabouts, and it's not at all straightforward. So when we talk about grief, it's really difficult to actually define, but it is like a cocktail of emotions, or lethal cocktail of emotions, really. And, if you think about a lethal cocktail, if you're not careful, you can get drunk really quickly. You can lose control. You can have a very prolonged hangover, and it could be really toxic to the system. So we have to learn a bit about brain chemistry, really, and get that cocktail right.
In the past, I've heard people explain it as like a very linear process where you go through anger, sadness, denial, acceptance. I don't know if that's the right order that people talk about. You've explained it in a completely different way. So can you expand on that for us?
Yes, I agree that all of these emotional states are part of the process. But the process isn't like, okay, today I'm doing my anger and then it's over. And then tomorrow I'm going to be doing my sadness. It doesn't really work like that. It's triggered off by so many different concepts, so many different experiences. So we might go into a supermarket and we might see a poinsettia, and then suddenly we'll remember, oh, my mum used to buy the first poinsettia at Christmas. And then suddenly you'll get a state of sadness or loneliness. So it's really unpredictable. So it's a bit like you just don't know what's going to hit you and when. So therefore, that's why I say to people, it's kind of like unexpected. So kind of expect the unexpected. Loneliness, there's that guilt. Guilt's a big one. Shock's a big one. Denial, anger, and all of this stuff is just sitting away in the system. With hypnotherapy, actually, we call it the stress bucket. We talk about the part of our brain that holds emotional stress. And this is the part of our brain that kind of holds that lump of grief, really. So if you imagine your stress bucket is just a bucket inside your brain, and, you know, usually you get through life and little things happen, bits get in, like little tiny pebbles. So imagine the bucket's a glass of water and you've got pebbles going in. So nothing really affects the surface of the water. But then when you get a bigger rock and you put it in, that's when the water overflows. So grief is a bit like that. It's a big, huge lump all at once. And that's why we get that emotional overwhelm or that feeling of overflow.
Okay, I get that. How does the brain process grief and loss then? What does it do with this tangled cocktail of emotions?
Well, the brain has two operating systems. We've talked about the emotional part of the brain. And the emotional part of the brain is the primitive part of the brain. So think of us when we were back in the cave. Not that we're old enough, Lucy. Cave women and cave dwellers. If you think about the brain's evolution, the part of the brain that was primitive was, you know, it was literally looking out for your safety, looking out for your survival. It's your threat brain. You know, it's there to keep you safe and it's there to keep you alive, essentially. And if you think about cavewomen and cavemen, they didn't have the ability to communicate at the levels that we do now. They didn't have, well, they didn't have speech, really, and they didn't have written word. They certainly didn't have, you know, Facebook and Snapchat podcasts to listen to. So very much their way of communicating with each other was through their emotions, and their emotions would have been, you know, quite, you know, strong ones like anger, anxiety, fear, that kind of thing. So that's our emotional brain. We've still got a primitive mind, and that's the limbic system. Mm-hmm. Then over the top has grown, through evolution, has grown our intellectual mind. The intellectual part of the mind is the part of our mind that is able to plan, you know, weigh things up properly, make sense of a situation. It's rational, it's logical. It's actually looking out for facts, it's looking out for evidence, it's checking out our current reality, and it's picking out the facts of what is right, rather than basing anything on, you know, the past of what may have been or potential dangers of the future, because that's the risk assessment part of the brain, which is the primitive mind. So the intellectual part of the brain is always making a proper assessment of a situation. So as you can imagine, you know, with what I've just said now, where does grief really sit within the part of our brain? It would sit in the emotional mind and it would spill over in our stress bucket. But when we've got an ability to remember that we have an intellectual capacity, we can apply that intellect to the emotion, and then that's the perfect balance of emotional intelligence, really.
Okay, so it's applying the intellect to kind of manage and control the emotions. Is that what you're saying?
Exactly, yes. And it's not about denying the emotions or suppressing them or pretending that they're not there. It's really about fully engaging with them and looking at them and observing them. In fact, being kind of curious about them. So in the end, you're not really fearful of them. It's usually with fear, you're fearful of the fear itself, not of the thing. So it's an interesting way of looking at things.
I think that's really interesting, because one of the things I talk to my students about is a concept. I don't actually usually use this word, but I'm going to now. It's a concept from psychology called metacognition. And it's basically the ability to kind of observe how you're learning while you're learning, so that you're aware of how you learn and what's working. And so I always talk to my students about this, like, as you're revising, having this awareness of, is it working? If it's not working, why it's not working? And all that kind of thing. And I think what you're talking about is similarly meta, isn't it? It's this kind of overlying intellectual curiosity and interrogation of the experience of grief. That's what you're saying, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. And that meta position is a different perspective. It's a kind of way of overseeing an example or a situation without kind of getting emotionally entangled in that situation. So you are you are creating that little bit of distance. It's exactly the same. It's like the third eye or the observer part of you. I mean, if we go into a real spiritual deep type of conversation, I would say that it would be a state of mind that exists within us that is totally undisturbed by gain or loss. So, you know, that's really going a bit deep there.
That's deep. Yeah, it's like that inner essence of you, isn't it? It's like, yeah. And kind of what you're trying to tap into when you're meditating or doing yoga and all that kind of stuff, isn't it?
Exactly, yes.
Yeah, okay.
That's what, you know, when you're aware, and you use the word awareness as well, when you're aware, then you've already started to kind of move towards acceptance of that situation, whatever the situation is.
Mm-hmm. I don't know whether this is going off piste a bit, but if you have this awareness, or if you are grieving and you're listening to this and you're thinking, but if I'm intellectually interrogating my emotions and my grief, does that mean I'm not grieving properly? And does that mean I'm betraying the person who I'm grieving for because I'm not feeling these strong emotions simply for what they are?
But what I'm suggesting is that you have to feel the emotions and be okay with feeling. So that's the thing about not denying them and not suppressing them and not ignoring them, but actually sitting with them and being okay not being okay. So there's a part of my book that says, you know, it's okay not to be okay. And giving ourselves permission not to be okay is that awareness again. So it's looking at our emotions, and instead of interrogating them, I prefer to use the word of just observing.
Mm-hmm.
So to me, interrogation sounds a bit judgmental, or it's a bit like you're doing this wrong, you're doing that right. So there's no wrong or right. It's just an observation. Like a scientist would observe, you know, the results of an experiment. There's no wrong or right. There's just what happened. So it's that type of awareness, really.
I think it's really interesting as well, thinking about this in this day and age. I'm currently listening to Arianna Huffington's book Thrive on Audible, and she talks about a lot about inner wisdom and kind of giving ourselves time to think and all this kind of stuff. And you're saying it's okay to not be okay. And I think there's a really strong message in society nowadays that you have to be okay all the time, and it's not good enough if you're not okay, because that kind of means you're broken. Does that make sense?
Exactly. And, you know, as we're recording this is Mental Health Awareness Month or week or whatever it is. You know, I think it's quite ridiculous that we have to have a Twitter, you know, hashtag to say mental health awareness. We should all be aware of our mental health at all times. You know, it shouldn't just be for a month or a week. Our mental health is underpinning everything that we do and everything that we say and how we react and respond and behave. So, you know, it's kind of that awareness. And, you know, we are human beings that are responding and reacting to life that is happening to us or not happening to us. And, you know, it's an organic process to get through life. None of us are born with a rule book to say, right, this is what you do now and this is what you do then. And mm-hmm. You know, it's just you have to just muddle through the best you can, don't you? And that's kind of what I suppose I sort of hope to teach, that permission to give yourself time. But also the interesting thing about time is one of the misconceptions about grieving is that time heals.
Mm.
I don't think it does heal on its own. Time only heals when you've done something within that time that helps that healing. So it's what you do in the time determines the quality of the healing.
That's really interesting. Okay, I want to return to this at the end, because at the moment I think it'd be more helpful to move on to some of the things you want to share about how to manage your grief, or how to make their grief better or good, like in the title of your book, Good Grief. So what can people do to make their grief better?
Well, grief is, as we've talked about, is a process. So we can really become aware of how to make the process easier. I have some really good tips and hints in the book, and there are a few that I'd like to share. So We all understand grief as being a pain or a situation that is uncomfortable. And it, you know, we talked about it being difficult. And it's that pressure, that pain, and that feeling of panic and overwhelm. And I call those the three P's. So it's three P's of pressure, pain, and panic. And we want to be able to find a fourth P within that. And I talk about the fourth P being positive. Now, when I say positivity, some people kind of roll their eyes at me and it's like that, oh no, just like think positively, you know. And it, I don't mean Pollyanna. I don't mean like annoying kind of bumper sticker Instagram quote positivity. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just like an alternative possibility that can be an anecdote. Antidote, to the solution to the problem. So it's a solution. We're looking for a solution. By definition, anyway, with the word problem, that has to have a solution to it. Otherwise, it wouldn't be called a problem. So that's the whole point of solution-focused hypnotherapy, is that it helps you look at a different sort of, it helps you kind of bring in a different mindset.
Mm-hmm. So what can people actually do then to help cultivate this non-cliched positivity?
Well, I believe that the underpinning thing, or the main thing, is to learn to relax. Relaxation is actually a skill. And, you know, we've talked about meditation and mindfulness, but also relaxation is something that really does help you engage with your intellectual mind. You can't be relaxed and anxious at the same time. I've never met anyone who can do the two successfully together. Mm-hmm. You can't be relaxed and stressed at the same time. You can't be relaxed and angry or relaxed and fearful at the same time. So in theory, if you learn to relax as a skill, then you're able to control and, you know, sort of step away, get in that meta position again of how to kind of hold the emotional mind in a sort of more successful way, really.
So how do you learn to relax?
Relaxation is a practice. It's something that we do as a default anyway with hypnotherapy. I mean, hypnosis as a word, it just means sleep in Greek. And so obviously to sleep, you have to get into relaxation first. That's why people who are insomniacs actually are, because they're stressed, you know, nobody can sleep when they're stressed. So relaxation is on the way to sleep, really. So there's a point of in between half awake and half asleep that we call REM, which is rapid eye movement. Mm-hmm. And when you're in that state of mind, that's actually also known as trance. And so, you know, trance can be a loaded word, but really just scientifically, trance is REM. And when you're in REM, your brain is absolutely in a neutral state, and it's able to kind of make a proper assessment of that situation. It's where your intellectual mind is on board, but also you're kind of holding the emotional mind over there, sort of thing. So you've got this kind of neutral space. That's deep relaxation. So relaxation is a skill that you can just be taught, and, you know, like you teach people skills. You can go to anybody, like a hypnotherapist would teach you relaxation, or a mindfulness expert would teach you relaxation, meditation people will teach you relaxation, yoga. You know, there's loads of different ways to relax. So when I talk about relaxation, I don't mean sitting on the sofa with a glass of wine or lying on the beach in Thailand. You know, that'd be nice, but yeah. It's not what I mean. It's an internal feeling.
Okay, so the first thing is to learn to relax. So have you got any other strategies for us?
Well, the interesting thing about the brain is how we use our imagination. And as you know, you've probably done this with your students. You've talked about how our imagination can really work with us or against us. Mm. And I always explain how our imagination works by using something called the lemon exercise. Would you like me to do a little demo of the lemon exercise?
Go for it. Yes, please.
So everyone can try this now. So it works better if you can close your eyes, but if you can't, obviously, if you're
driving, don't close your eyes.
On a bike, please don't do that. But if you can close your eyes, do that. So if you've got your eyes closed, that's fine. If you haven't, that's fine as well. You can still use your imagination with your eyes open. But imagine you have on a chopping board in front of you a big, juicy, one of those Sicilian yellow lemons, you know, those really big, juicy ones. I'd like you to imagine that you're cutting the lemon in half. So really begin to see what's inside the lemon, the pips, the segments, maybe the vibrant yellow of the lemon, and just start to notice the juice running out of it. And then I'd like you to imagine that you're cutting that lemon into a quarter. And now, as vividly as you can, imagine that you're putting that quarter lemon, that juicy lemon, up to your lips. And you can start to taste the really sharp lemon juice inside your mouth. And it's starting to activate your saliva glands. So if you did that, Lucy, what happened with you?
Yeah, it was so vivid. Yeah, I could just see it. I could imagine, like, the, you know, the pores on the outside of the lemon, and yeah, just how big and juicy and yellow it was. And then, yeah, the saliva came in my mouth when you said that at the end. It was amazing.
So that's a really good example of, you know, you don't actually have a lemon in front of you. I don't think you do.
No, I don't.
That lemon just existed in your imagination. So that is a really amazing exercise to realize how our imagination can change our physical physiology. Mm. So if you think about it, we can imagine our way into stress, even if there isn't a stressful situation, because it might be a perception of stress. Mm. But equally, we can imagine our way into relaxation. Mm. And that's how powerful our imagination is. So that's why solution-focused hypnotherapy relies on relaxation, first of all. Then it relies on your imagination, and, of course, putting your imagination into a positive place rather than a negative place.
Okay, brilliant. Well, thank you for that. I think you've got one other strategy to share with us, haven't you, Dipti?
Yeah, and that's called the no yes principle. And it's quite an easy principle. This is more of a kind of quick kind of diagnostic tool, really. So the key question, there's some questions that are linked to the no yes principle. So imagine that you're feeling, I don't know, say anxious before an exam. You know, you're about to go into biology and you're standing at the gym door and you've got that horrible sinking anxiety feeling and you feel sick and you feel like you've got a headache. So the first question to ask yourself is my current feeling useful? And hopefully, if you ask yourself that question, you'll probably come up with no. Mm-hmm. It's not very useful. So then the second question is, do I want to change how I'm feeling? And hopefully you'll then think, yes, I actually do, because no one in their right mind will want to go into their biology exam feeling sick. Mm-hmm. So in that way, what you're doing is you're giving your brain a choice. And of course, when you feel like you've got a choice, you feel like you're more in control.
And then relaxed, you ask, yeah.
Exactly. And then you ask yourself, what feeling do I want to move towards? And then your brain is using its imagination about what it wants. So that's another principle I use. It's called the Google brain. And the Google brain is, if you were sort of typing something into Google because you were looking for something, you would obviously type in the thing you're looking for, not the thing you're not looking for. So, for example, if I say to somebody, what do you want to be feeling? They might say to me, I don't want to feel anxious. But if you typed in anxious to Google, you'll just get loads of reference to anxiety. Mm-hmm. So what you need to tell your brain is what you want rather than what you don't want. So then I say, okay, well, what do you want to be feeling? And they'll be like, well, I've just told you, I don't want to be feeling anxious. They say, yeah, but what do you want to be feeling? And then they eventually get it and they'll say, oh, well, I want to feel the opposite of anxious. And then, what's that? And they have to really think about it because they're so used to thinking about what they don't want. They haven't really thought about what they do want. Mm-hmm. And then they might say, oh, I want to be feeling calm, for example. Mm-hmm. I want to be feeling in control. So then when your brain hears the word calm or in control, then of course it has to bring up references to what does calm and in control feel like. And then you ask yourself, what is the small thing that I can do now to move towards this preferred feeling? And how will I know I'm there? So you're kind of giving yourself this little talking to, in a way.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why it's called the no yes principle, because it has to start with a no and then it has to be followed by a yes. So is my current feeling useful? No. Do I want to change how I'm feeling? Yes.
Yeah, that's so interesting, because I think that's something that I've always done throughout my life without really knowing it was a thing. So, yeah. You know, like when I went into exams, I was always calm, confident and in control. But I might have had that moment when I was standing outside and, you know, that fluttering of butterflies in my tummy. I'd be like, no, I don't want that.
Yeah.
Let's focus on the positive. And, I can think of so many occasions, even, you know, in my daily life now, where I make those choices to take the positive route rather than the negative route. And yeah, it's really powerful, isn't it?
It's so powerful, because you're actually in charge of how you feel through your thought. And if you know that at some level, of course, we can't always change our emotions, because they are very powerful. But quite often we can change our thinking. And that's a whole other podcast, I think, in itself.
Yeah, so if we, with those three exercises, how do they actually apply to the grieving process then? I understand how the first two help you to relax and the second one helps you to think more positively or put yourself in a more positive frame of mind. But how do they apply to the grieving process?
Well, I suppose the grieving process is something that really what we want to achieve by the end of it really is the acceptance of the grieving process itself. I mean, I always say to everyone, the only way to grieve is through grief, and the only way through grief is to grieve. Mm-hmm. So there is no shortcut, you know, there is no quick fix really. It is just the process to be in. So how do we actually turn the bad grief into good grief is by understanding that grief is a non-negotiable. You know, it's something that we're just going to have to go through, but how can we remain within that meta position throughout the whole process, if that makes sense?
Okay. So with this mum who sent me a Facebook message a couple of weeks before the exam started, saying that her mother had died and her daughter was about to take her GCSEs and she didn't know how to help her to deal with the grief and focus on the revision and all that kind of thing. What's your advice to somebody in that situation?
I would actually say to somebody like that, you know, honour what you're going through. And, you know, be realistic as well. So it's not about pretending that you're in a good place or your mental health is absolutely on fire. You know, it doesn't have to be like that. And so it's about recognizing, you know, where you are needing support, where you are needing help. And, you know, like she has reached out to you in this way, that's her way of finding her own strategies and working it out for herself, because she knows that she's got to hold it together for her daughter. So it's about recognizing where you are in your mind and how you can use the grief to help you rather than hinder you. Because I think there is a lot of strength in grief. Mm-hmm. And so all we have to do is kind of learn to channel it appropriately, really.
Yeah, because I said to this mum, you know, what would your mum, the lady who died, what would she have wanted in this situation? You know, and the mum said that her own mother was very strong and that she would have wanted her granddaughter to keep revising and do her very best. And, you know, so for me, it was about honouring the grandmother's memory by putting the energy into the revision and not getting off track. Is that sensible? Is it doable advice in your experience?
Yeah, I mean, obviously we all do things differently. So I guess in a way, honouring the person isn't there anymore is a way of giving them some airtime, you know, and using that energy in a way that keeps that person alive, really.
Mm-hmm.
Is that something that you is a positive, but also being realistic in what you would do naturally. So it's not about only doing what that person would want you to do, but kind of combining it with how you feel as well. I think it's about finding that kind of connection with yourself and that authenticity within you, and absolutely being okay with whatever happens. But remember, when you're okay with whatever happens, you've really moved into an acceptance of even the, I've got my inverted comma fingers going on here, the what is bad, you know. So instead of labeling, this is bad, this is not acceptable, this is good, it's just, it is what it is, if that makes sense.
Yeah, so it's just about being in it and experiencing it and not saying, I want to get rid of it or anything like that.
Yeah, yeah, and it's being with it in that way that is kind to you. Because, you know, at this time, there has to be a level of kindness, you know, around you, and that is supportive.
Definitely. Okay, well, what you've shared has been really, really helpful, a really great insight into how the brain works. Even if people aren't grieving, if they are just dealing with something that is emotionally overwhelming, or just trying to, you know, have that positive frame of mind as they go into the exam hall. Is there anything else you'd like to share with us today, Dipti, before we round up?
I think practice is, you know, in awareness, and helps you kind of cultivate those qualities that we've talked about. So, like, you know, when we started off talking about that tangled ball of string, mm-hmm. like, you know, I don't know if you've ever done this, shoved your earphones in your bag and then get them out. And then it's like, oh my goodness, how am I supposed to untangle this? But, you know, the motivation to untangle the earphones is because you want to use them. So that, you know, it's not just a tangled ball of string that you can throw away. But if you've ever tried to unpick it, it starts off a bit difficult. You know, you need a bit of patience, you need a bit of focus, you need a bit of dedication and concentration, commitment, small tugs, and the first bit loosens, and then you get that feeling of hope, and it gets easier, and then it starts to unravel. It's easy to give up at the first hurdle, but if you just keep pulling, just keep tugging, just keep unraveling, it eventually just starts to kind of move into that kind of feeling of, I think I'm okay now. And even if I'm not okay, I'm still okay.
So it's all about persistence and belief in your own ability to recover, really.
Yes, and it is that awareness of your own internal capabilities and resources. And that gives you a sense of personal hope.
Definitely. Thank you, Dipti. Okay, if people want to get more help from you or find out more about you, where can I find you?
Well, I have two websites. One of them is being literally made as we speak, so hopefully by the time this goes out, it will be live. And that one is to work with me online, and that's diptitate.com. And then to work with me in real life in the Cotswolds, you can find me at thecotswoldpractice.com. Mm-hmm. On Twitter, I'm at dipnotherapy.
I love that.
I know, I don't have a consistent brand name, which is a bit naughty of me. And then on Skype, on YouTube, I'm Dipti the Hypnotherapist, and I have loads of free content there.
Fantastic. Well, it's been a real pleasure to talk to you today, and thank you so much for sharing your expertise with people who are desperately in need of it at this time.
Thank you so much for asking me. It's been fun.
Thank you. Bye-bye, Dipti.
Bye, Lucy.
Wasn't that a great interview with Dipti? I think she really showed us the power that we actually have in our brains and in our minds to help us deal with overwhelm and grief if we really know how to harness it properly. So if you have been struggling with these issues, then I really encourage you to check out Dipti's book. And if you think you need a bit more personalised help, see how you could work with Dipti with her hypnotherapy practice. So yeah, thank you so much for listening today. The show is coming up to being a year old, so if you would be kind enough to leave a review on iTunes, then I would really appreciate that. You can do that through your podcast app on your phone, or you can do it through the iTunes app on your computer. So please do that and help me spread the word about the podcast so that more people can benefit from it. So thank you so much for listening. Have a wonderful day. And goodbye.